Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Angela Heathcote, and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. This episode, I'm talking to David Watson. David is an ecologist and powerful voice in the so-called Brumby debate. His resignation from a government advisory board went viral after he posted it on Twitter. He's a man who truly stands on one side of the fence and is not afraid to talk about it. So I'm really excited to talk to David today for this episode of Talking Australia. Before we start our conversation with David, it's important to acknowledge that the debate around managing wild horse populations in the Australian alpine areas is a truly heated debate. We would love to hear your opinion and encourage you to share it with us on our social channels. But now, let's hear our guest. David, thank you so much for being with me today.
The pleasure is mine.
Now, we've just caught David at a really opportune moment. He's just been down at the New South Wales Parliament, which is just up the road from Australian Geographic, which is really convenient. And we'll go into a little bit about what you've been talking about there later on. But what I want to do first off is I want to go back to that time in June 2018 when I guess you were kind of catapulted into the public conversation around conservation and Brumbies or feral horses, depending on what side of the fence you sit on. Tell me about that moment in time.
Sure. So so back then, I was a member of the New South Wales Threatened Species Committee, Scientific Committee. That's the body that speaks to state government and advises them about which species, which populations, which communities are in trouble and need to be listed as either endangered, critically endangered, or in happy news, downlisted. Like they were endangered, we've now done good things, their numbers are prospering, so they don't need to be endangered anymore. Pretty finicky work. Like you sit down, you crunch through all the literature, you tap researchers on the shoulder and say, hey, we've read your paper about that weird orchid that's found on that one hill. Could you give us a bit more information about numbers, like pollinators? What's the threatening process? Why is it so rare? Are there pigs around? Like just help us read between the lines. So it's detailed work, it's thorough work. A lot of it's about threatened species, but some of it is also about key threatening processes. And one of the key threatening processes that had gone through was about deer. They're an introduced animal. They have a whole range of negative effects on plants, on habitats. So that had gone through. And then feral horses as a key threatening process was in the works. And one of my colleagues on the committee was responsible for doing that work, going through all the studies, both in Australia and elsewhere, and not unique to a particular place, just in New South Wales at a state level, and especially looking at impacts of these animals on threatened species. And as that literature was coming together, we'd meet monthly. So I live in just out of Albury, and so I'd get up, you know, well before the birds, get an early flight to Sydney with a ream of papers, like 300-400 page, you know, agendas, crunching through all those different drafts. And one of those drafts that I saw many, many times and commented on and advised on and we argued, oh, can you say that? No, you can't say that. That's too strong. Literature doesn't say that. We need to adjust that right down. It was about feral horses. And then in the middle of that pretty tedious process, this draft bill appeared from who was the Deputy Premier of New South Wales, John Barilaro. Suggesting that in one national park, and there's no precedent of this, there are no bills in any state that relate to a single national park. This is crazy stuff. This bill appears saying that feral horses in this particular national park, in Kosciuszko National Park, need to be maintained as a significant component of the cultural heritage of this place. And it's like, bloody hell, that's ridiculous. Surely that's not going to get up. And so quietly, I had an informal chat with my chair, the chair of the committee, having wrestled with this and said, look, on the remote chance that this gets up, I can't in good conscience continue on this committee. I can't in good conscience continue to get up way before dawn, get on a plane, spend weeks going through all this stuff, knowing that the government of the day will just say, oh yeah, look, thanks mate, thanks prof.
Like your advice wouldn't be taken seriously.
It makes a mockery of it. So why would I continue to deliver considered advice when it's going to be chucked in the bin? So I gave my chair a preview of this, and then much to my surprise, the bill not only was passed, but it was roundly supported. The environment minister of the time, Gabrielle Upton, gave it her strong support, saying it struck the right balance, whatever the hell that means. And it's like, right, that's it. That day, I sat down fuming. I removed the naughty words, wrote the letter, sent it to Minister Upton, and then almost as an afterthought, took a screenshot and thought, look, let's see what the Twitterers make of this, because I knew that all the good people behind the scenes in OEH, in parks, their lips are buttoned.
Yeah, right.
They are not able to talk about this sort of stuff. That's secret squirrel business. You can't talk about that stuff. You can have all sorts of opinions about it. You can't share them. You can't speak publicly about this stuff or you get sacked. And I couldn't either as a current member of that committee.
So you made that decision to remove yourself?
I made that decision to remove myself, and I thought I'd use that to shine light on this issue, call attention to it and say, hey, people, this is not right. This is a government that is no longer listening. This is a government that asks experts for their advice, and then when they get the advice that they don't really want to hear, chuck it in the bin.
We're going to go more into that bill later on, but I want to go back to, I guess, the changing perceptions of horses in Australia, Brumbies, feral horses. I guess they've been here since 1788. They were this cultural icon for so long. At what point did scientists kind of gather enough research to say, wait a second, these are having a terrible impact on the Australian environment in several areas, particularly the alpine regions? When did that kind of, I guess, research start trickling in? When did the perception kind of change from cultural icon to, I guess, maybe environmental degradation?
Okay, so there's a few key names that crop up. Maisie Carr was one of the big ones. So she was a legend in all sorts of ways. She was a pioneer. She was a plant ecologist who worked in northeast Victoria, in the high country there, and Alec Costin as well, who's still around. He's still with us, and was wanted to be there in person at the Feral Horse Symposium in Canberra in November last year, but sort of videoed in his contribution. So I think those two early voices said, "Well, wait a minute, there's some issues here," and they were both in the high country. But many others have been really concerned about the effect of horses as hoofed animals across Australia, because, I mean, there's a lot of concern about the effect horses are having in the high country.
And what is that effect?
So it's many things, but it's Australia-wide. If there are horses around, they are having an effect. Now, then you need to ask the question, what effect? And are we happy with that effect? And one of the key things to bear in mind is they're a hoofed animal. And Australia is a weird place. Along with Antarctica, it's the only continent that never had a hoofed animal evolve in its entire history. So our soils are very old, they're weathered, they're very shallow, and so the minute that sheep and cattle arrived in Australia, all these hard-fought nutrients, all this gorgeous, loamy, sponge-cakey soil, within a year or two, gone, smashed. Even before there were any fixed dwellings, when squatters moved a mob of sheep into New England, all the lakes filled up with mud, like straight away. The literature on this just makes you scream. So one of the secrets to understanding why this is such a problem is looking at the feet of the animal. Compare a macropod, a kangaroo, large animal, maybe 60, 70 kilos, a giant one, maybe 90, with its great big furry foot distributing its weight and its big tail as well, just quietly doing its thing, as opposed to a horse, which weighs a whole lot more than that, and it's like it's on stilettos, clomping around in the...
I am picturing that in my head right now, and well, I can't.
And it's serious pressure. So yes, they eat a lot. They also drink a lot, and in order to drink a lot, up in the high country, where do they get it? They get it in little creek lines that are lined with sphagnum bogs. They get it in a wetland that's in the middle of a peatland. So just to get there, just to get into it, they're sinking up hock deep in this stuff, squidging out all the water, and then when it gets dry in the summertime, that sphagnum blows away. when it gets dry in the summertime, that peat burns if it's dry. So yes, it's a herbivore. There's lots of herbivores. There's kangaroos, there's broad-toothed rats, there's all sorts of things that eat plants. The eating stuff is not nearly as big a problem as the trampling.
Right.
And there's other things that trample. So there's deer, there's goats, there's pigs, there's many hoofed animals in Australia, there's donkeys. They're all problematic. But Australia's high country is tiny, it's very fragile, it's got a very short growing season, and it's running out of room because, you know, the elephant in the room is climate change. Mm-hmm. Tree line is galloping up the mountain. And all these little things that are just sitting on the rooftop of Australia, just this tiny little bit, they're running out of room. They're just marching up and up and up and up and up the slope. And so now, of all times, right now, we should be going, whoa, okay, let's prioritise and let's have some tough decisions about can't save everything. Because, you know, Australia's got really short mountains. Like, they can't keep going. They'll end up in the clouds, and a pygmy possum can't live, you know, in the air. So what do? Do we move them? Do we move them elsewhere? When we should be having those very difficult discussions, instead, we're talking about bloody horses and treating them as some sort of sacred beastie up in the high country. And this is actually not about horses as a special thing or not a special thing. I love horses. They're great. Just not in a national park. That's the nub of this issue. You can have horses and you can have protected areas, but you can't have horses in a protected area and still do all the things that protected area was gazetted to do. It's they're mutually incompatible.
And when the government heard this new research from the scientists saying, look, this is a bad idea, guys, this is what's happening, what was the policy initially for Kosciuszko National Park and all the high countries?
So they were two ships passing in the night. They didn't talk to each other at all. So that should have come through us. That should have come through the scientific committee, this stuff, but it didn't. It was launched on everyone at the same time. There was no consultation with OEH staff at all. So at that stage, the draft...
I guess when I'm talking about policy, I mean all those years ago when it comes to...
Oh, my mistake. It's like, yeah, sure, yes. And that was part of the reasoning for reducing and then stopping grazing, seasonal grazing, of cattle grazing in the high country. And that caused furor because that was, again, this cultural stuff. Oh, you know, it's our heritage. It's our heritage. How dare you? And then the more you looked into it, it's like, well, it's actually quite a small number of families and you choose to... move your cattle up there and eat away it's a bit like mining. It's like it's all of ours. It's not really yours. You profit from it and you're doing it for free. So you can't really, you know, get too hot and bothered about it. And then horses, I guess, have always been there.
Well, how have they been managed over that time?
They have been managed much more actively in the past.
Yeah.
And there's, you'll hear... You talk to five horse people, you'll get 10 opinions about the distinctiveness of the horses in Australia's high country. There are some animals derived from wild horses in the high country that are reasonably distinctive animals. A lot of animals get moved around. A lot of stallions still are let go intentionally in areas to improve bloodlines. People will try and get in there and take a particular animal. But there's far fewer horsey people now than there were back then in that area. And so there's a lot of people who claim to love horses. But when you round up these wild horses, okay, so who wants them? Like for free? Nobody wants them.
Right.
And the last time this was done, it's terrible business. The last time there was a large, you know, muster... of feral horses in the high country. Most of them were shipped off to an abattoir in Adelaide. The worst possible outcome. These poor animals were rounded up, were in yards, kept for a very long time. All the Brumby folk like, well, come on, come get your special horses. A tiny fraction, I think 18% of the animals that were caught were rehomed, and the rest were shipped off to the abattoir that deals with horses across the country.
We'll be back with our conversation with David Watson just after this. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's 3 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you will also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au /talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. We're back with our conversation with David Watson. I wanted to zoom in on something that you said just before about how they were well managed in the past.
Better managed.
Better managed. I know there was that situation in the year 2000 when there was that aerial cull that kind of, I think it was Guy Fawkes River National Park.
Yep.
And that seemed to really, I guess, invigorate people and maybe change people's minds about culling. Can you talk about that event and I guess the significance of that?
Sure. So that was a situation where there was trained marksmen that were brought in from a helicopter that were shooting horses in very inaccessible rocky gorge country. So if you're going to control an animal in that sort of country, you've pretty much got to do it from the air. Just accessing that those areas is not practicable on foot. And some people went in immediately after that cull was conducted and found unimaginable horror of seeing all these dead animals, you know, around. A high-velocity bullet to a horse's head is not a pretty outcome. And a few of the animals had been were still alive, hadn't been killed with that first shot. And I think there was a legitimate outcry to that. That's an outcome that nobody wants. Nobody is happy about that situation. But I think the public tends to be very one-eyed about these sorts of things. Let's talk about horses. Let's talk about racehorses. And let's talk about the slow racehorses. What happens to them? A lot of horses are killed every single year. There was this great big brouhaha that got stirred up about greyhounds. It's like, come on, people, just think it through. How many of these dogs are bred? How many of these dogs are fast? How many of these dogs fail at their first race? And where do they all go? The world is not full of greyhounds. They're killed, and they're killed in the thousands. This happens all the time.
Do you feel like that event in the 2000s, though, really, I guess, invigorated the debate about how to manage the horses? Because people who typically weren't engaged in that conversation then came in and said, wait a second, this is animal cruelty. And then they, I guess, invigorated the other camp?
It certainly played into that, and I think still it resonates very strongly in minds of many people. Aerial culling is seen as a bit too hard for the general public to stomach, so let's not even talk about it. Even though we know it is the most efficient way, the RSPCA has come out very strongly on this and saying it is the most humane way to kill these animals.
So that you would say that that's the best way to manage the populations?
I would. But I would also say that because of the risk-averse governments that we currently have in this grand nation of ours, that politicians will not sign on to those sorts of control measures. Feral animal control generally is not a very sexy topic. It's pretty hard to get policymakers excited about killing rabbits or goats or pigs. And we have problems with it across the country. It costs billions of dollars. Currently, in many states and territories in Australia, feral animal control exists in paper only. There's very little that's actually being done. I've worked in Western parks in inland Australia for 15, 20 years, and I've seen feral animal numbers go through the roof. It's a very long way from Hurstville. It's a very long way from Sydney. This year, on the 1st of July, the parks of Western New South Wales went from having 9 rangers to 4. So all this discussion we're having about one particular national park and one particular feral animal in that national park needs to be understood within the context of our entire national parks estate that's being... The budgets are shrinking. And just the core business that you think they're doing, they're not doing. They're doing their best. There's dedicated people doing their level best with the resources they've got. And each budget comes around and they've got less money. They've got to put off staff and they're losing all this expertise.
So with that focus now on the one national park, the one feral animal, I'm wondering from that that event in 2000 to now, would you say the back and forth kind of skirmish around the policy or whether or not to aerial cull the animals, what to essentially do with them, has culminated in the bill that you actually ended up resigning for?
I don't think so. I really do think that the heritage bill that landed in New South Wales Parliament is a red herring. And I think that's that comes from small beer, small politics, electioneering of one particular individual, panding to interests in his particular electorate, and having an eye to his own political career, whether at a state or federal level. It caught a lot of people in his own party room on the hop. It's like, where did this come from? This flies in the face of all the stuff that we care about. The current Environment Minister of New South Wales is not happy about this at all. And yet it's the Deputy Premier that put this bill before him.
So how did it happen? What were the forces that be?
I'm probably not best placed to talk about that. I am no political animal. But there's vested interests that are being talked about. There's money to be made from touring, from taking people up to the high country to see wild horses, and there's pretty clear links between some of the loudest voices proposing this sort of thing and business people who are making money from exactly these activities, and that's been trotted out in the wider media. I'm not telling any fibs here. So I think rather than being some very large scale difference of opinion, this is an isolated aberration that is going to be repealed sooner or later, and then we can get back to the core business of looking after national parks for all the cultural heritage, for all the biodiversity, for all Australians, and start to jack up the budgets a bit more, because what we're doing to them now is unconscionable.
And you mentioned that the then Environment Minister talked about this particular bill, which is the Wild Horse Heritage Bill 2018. You said that her perception was that it struck the right balance, which obviously you disagree with. But in your eyes, what is the right balance?
Sure. I think we need to have that discussion. And the balance needs to be predicated on evidence of impacts. And as I mentioned, the whole budgetary issues, there's no monitoring being done in these parks. We don't know what it used to look like, so we can't know just how much damage has been done. Some of that work has been done in similar habitats in northeast Victoria, around buffalo. That was presented at the Feral Horse Science Symposium in Canberra in November, and is written up in a journal article in Environmental Management and Restoration, looking at horse densities around Mount Buffalo in northeast Victoria, showing that at very low densities, like 5-6 animals to the square kilometre, you're still seeing horses, 5-6 horses to the square K. Double check those figures. You're seeing measurable impacts on creek erosion, on water quality, on riparian vegetation. So really low numbers. So this is not about eradication. This is not about coming in and saying we need to make the high country horse free. Nobody, seriously, is coming in and saying that's what we need to reach for. We're saying it's a fragile system. It's very small. It's getting smaller. There's a whole lot of endemic animals and plants that are found only there. These horses are having a major effect, along with deer, along with pigs, along with rabbits. Let's not hold them up as some sacred beastie that we need to look after and keep there. Let's look at the effects they're having. Let's look at what we need to do to get their numbers right down to a point where the locals can start to thrive again. Because what we're seeing now is entire slopes denuded. When it rains, all that sediment that's taken tens of thousands of years to build up is clogging up these creek lines. It's a disaster.
So that was your advice, and the government basically said, well, we're not taking that on.
They didn't even see it, because those two pieces of legislation didn't cross each other. The Brumby Bill was passed before the key threatening process recommendation went to the minister. So they knew it was coming. We tell them what we're doing. They see drafts. The draft was out for public comment. It came back. There were some minor changes. We were working on those. And there's the Brumby Bill. It's like, really?
Yeah. And what was your what was the reaction that you got when you did post that resignation letter on Twitter?
It was fascinating. So as a nerd, you know, I'm not that interested in, you know, hits and likes and all that garbage. But it went bananas. All sorts of people came out of the woodwork in very strong support. And from interesting quarters, a lot of self-described horsey people came out and directly wrote to me and said, thank you. This is important. You've taken a stand. We're not happy at all about this situation either.
I was actually curious about what your interactions have been with what you call horsey people.
Well, it's what they call themselves. I mean, they're good people. And a bit like, you know, farmers and greenies. It's their labels that relate to people who enjoy doing the same thing, spending time in nature. So I think, you know, my wife is mad for horses. You know, it's. I think a lot of the people involved in this debate have their own horses. A lot of biologists who work on this stuff spend time outside, have properties, move around their properties on horseback. So this isn't about vilifying the animal at all. This is about saying, not there. Not there, not in those numbers. So yes, I was really pleased by just the resounding support that I got from all quarters, from park staff, because a lot of the people involved behind the scenes in OEH, they can't talk publicly about this. They can't. But I received very strong support from them, a couple of you know, of trolls, but you know, so it goes.
I'm wondering about the reaction that you got from giving scientific advice to the government, them rejecting that advice and then creating a different bill, which you obviously resigned over. I'm wondering, on a broader scale, how do you think scientists overall felt about a government not taking its advice? Because obviously there are a lot of committees that are dedicated to providing independent advice across the board. What does it kind of say on a broader scale?
Yeah, see, that's why I got super cranky about this and thought I can't in good conscience continue, because this is far more important than biodiversity. This is about how you treat expert opinion, whether it's about skin cancer, whether it's about you know, infant nutrition or engineering or how to build a proper apartment block. There's all sorts of important things going on in the world today. It's complicated stuff. So the way a lot of governments conduct this business is they get together a bunch of people, well-trained people, experienced people, people who know a lot of stuff, get them together and say, hey, can you give us your considered opinion on this? Can you just do the hard yards, do the due diligence, work through all that complexity and tell us what we should do, and so we can then govern in the best interest? And that's not happening. Increasingly, whether it's falling down apartments, whether it's environment departments that are providing advice that's then ignored, whether it's, you know, pharmacists saying this is a particular drug that should be listed and the health department doing the exact opposite. And I'm as flummoxed as the next person regarding how this has come to be and what on earth we as thinking citizens can do about it. Because I want to know that if I'm driving on a bridge, that bridge can handle the weight of my ute. That's not too much to ask. But increasingly, I'm a bit worried.
And let's talk about what's happening right now with the bill. Tell us a little bit about why you were there.
The mood in the New South Wales Parliament right now, as we speak, is this bill is an aberration. It came out of left field. It is going to go away sooner or later. But let's keep our eyes on the much bigger issue here, and that is about the entire National Parks estate, and that is about looking after it and not undermining it and not monetizing it, not looking to make a buck out of these parks. That's not what they're for.
Well, thank you for being with me today, David.
Pleasure.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia with David Watson. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks for listening. Until next time.